not enough material, but it seems like I have too much. But that's what happens when you have all those daughters. Whenever you have a chance to talk, you take it. That's why I say I'm a pastor. It's my one chance to talk all week. But we're going to look at what's a parent to do. What's a parent to do? And maybe if we have time, we'll get to the section on fathers. But Ephesians chapter 6. I don't know if you guys remember Rubik's Cubes. And when I was growing up, at least, those were very, very popular. And the thing about a Rubik's Cube that makes it really sort of frustrating is that it looks so simple. I mean, the objective is very obvious. You just have each side the same color. But achieving that goal, at least for me, was pretty hard. I don't think that I ever actually was able to get a Rubik's Cube right without help. Though if I look on YouTube, there are guys who can like do Rubik's Cubes behind their backs without looking, but I never was one of those kind of people. There's a difference, obviously, between knowing what you want to do and knowing how to do it. And that's also true for parenting. I mean, it's pretty easy to know children obey your parents. Actually, the section on parenting in the Bible that's specifically addressed to parents is pretty short. There's not like a lot that's there. But when you go up to your child's room to wake up them up from a nap and you smell something and you notice that they took off their nappy and they went around their room leaving their mark all over the place, or when you go into the kitchen and you discover that your son took out a pair of scissors and chopped off his sister's hair, or when you go to the grocery store and your child gets so upset about not being allowed to have a 25-cent ring that they throw such a loud temper tantrum in the grocery store that the manager has to help you carry them out to the car, or when you ask your teenager to take out the trash and you receive a sarcastic reply about how he's the only one who has to do any work around the house. Now that's where it gets tricky. It gets tricky to take Ephesians 6, 1 through 4 and figure out, what do I do now? Which is why you need to know not only what Jesus wants from your children, you need to know what Jesus wants from you. You need to know your responsibilities. What does God want from us as parents? And as you look down at Ephesians 6, 4, God keeps it simple. He doesn't leave us guessing. He gives us two specific responsibilities. The first is this, fathers. And I think there he's emphasizing the particular special role that fathers play in the family, but of course not minimizing the work of a mother. But he says, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. So that's our first responsibility. But bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. That's the second. So the first responsibility Paul gives us as parents is not to provoke our children to anger. So we could say this, we have a responsibility not to parent in such a way that makes it easier for our children to sin. Now that's a negative kind of command, stop or don't. And though it seems simple, don't provoke your children to anger, I think there's a lot of truth here. And actually, it's a shocking way for Paul to begin when you think about the culture in which he was writing. Because in those days, a father could basically do whatever he wanted in his family and nobody thought much of it. The father was king, pretty much. So what they might have expected Paul to write here was, children, don't provoke your father to anger. But never the other way around. They would have always thought in terms of the child's responsibility to the father, not the father's responsibility to the children. And the fact is, it's still like that in some families. You know, a lot's changed in the world, but that hasn't changed for everybody. There are still some families where there's a lot of talk about the way children are to respect their parents, but it would sound really strange to talk about the parents' responsibilities to their children. And the truth is, I think it's very typical in every culture, though it looks different in different cultures, but it's very typical for parents to use their children for their own good. Because by nature, we're self-centered. We tend to use our children for our own pleasure. The gospel, though, when you believe the gospel, it turns your world upside down, and it trains you to think differently than your culture. God's grace frees you from having to be a puppet who acts the way everyone else around you does. And one of the ways the gospel changes you is in regard to the way you view positions of power and authority, like being a parent. Because by God's grace, we've been shown the way our king used his authority to serve us, we aren't going to spend all of our time as leaders thinking about how people should treat us. Instead, we're going to spend some time as leaders thinking about how we should serve them. We take responsibility. And I think this is actually one of the signs that a leader has really understood the gospel. And that is, at the core of his being, his attitude towards leadership has changed. Instead of viewing his position of leadership as a privilege given to him, which he can use to force others to serve him for his pleasure, he uses the privilege of his position as leader as an opportunity to serve them for God's pleasure instead. So the gospel flips upside down the way people think about leadership and the way fathers and mothers think about the leadership God's given them. Specifically, they begin to think carefully about whether or not the way they're treating their children is actually tempting them, or to say it more strongly and use the word Paul uses, provoking them to anger. I mean, there are some leaders who would never think that, but the gospel flips us upside down and enables us to think about the way in which we're using our leadership positions for the good of our children. So when it comes to parenting, the first thing you want people to consider in terms of their responsibilities is, are you parenting in a way that makes it easier for your children to become angry? Now, there's a parallel passage to this. That means a passage that talks a lot like this one, but says something just a bit different. If you go to Colossians again, Colossians 3:21, Paul says a similar statement, but it's just different enough to be worth looking at. He says, fathers, do not provoke your children, and here it is, lest they become discouraged. So in Ephesians, he says, lest they become angry. And then in Colossians, he says, lest they become discouraged. And I like those passages together because those reactions are two opposite sides of the same coin. Sometimes people respond to poor parenting by losing heart and becoming discouraged. And other times people respond to poor parenting by freaking out and becoming angry. And sometimes the same person goes back and forth between those two responses in the same day. But the point is, when you have a poor leader, you find the people he's leading either have no courage, they're just resigned, weak, or they're in revolt or rebellion against him. And if you think about it, there are a lot of countries with dictators like that. So many of the people are either just weak, they've given up, or they have constant rebellion. And that same thing can happen in churches, and it can happen in families, where the person leading tempts the other person to either just give up or to become angry. And this is really important for us to understand, because sometimes when we have angry people in the family or we have discouraged people in the family, we focus on the person who's getting angry. And we should. They have a responsibility. But here's the thing. They're not the only ones with a responsibility. So remember that. Because Paul is saying here, obviously, you can do things that makes it easier for another person, and in particular your child, to become sinfully angry or discouraged. When you see a child who's throwing temper tantrums and freaking out all the time, if it's your child, you need to ask yourself as a parent, am I to blame? Is there something about the way I'm parenting that is provoking my child to act like this? And this is tough to do, because of course you don't want to think that about yourself, but I know sometimes we see children who are not getting angry, and then we see other children who are getting angry, and sometimes people will just say, well, those two children just have completely different personalities. And so it's just the way it is. And that, you know, we don't want to just write that off. Children do have different temperaments. There's just no question that there are, just like we do, there are definitely, without a doubt, some children that are, just like we have our instinctive sins, they have their instinctive sins. And for some children, they seem to be more instinctively angry, at least out on the outside. But at the same time, it's not always just that. There can be another element to that, and that is the way the parent is acting towards the child. And we should at least be willing to look at it. That's the point. Now, I don't think it's your job to look at other people's children and other parents and figure out whether it's the child's temperament or behavior, unless they ask for your help. I don't think we need to go around seeing a kid throwing a temper tantrum and say, well, that's you're to blame, buddy. Because that often leads to pride in our lives, because we might look at our kids and think, oh, they're not getting as angry, we're better. No, that's foolishness. But in your own relationships and with people that are asking for your help, you do need to stop and think, what are some ways that parents can provoke their children to anger? Because obviously, if this is the first responsibility, we need to think about, how do we do that? How do parents actually do that? And what I want to do is just give you 20 or so ways that parents provoke their children to anger. And I'm not making these up. They actually come from the book of Proverbs. Because as you read through Proverbs, what you find are all these statements, and you can do this on your own if I don't get all of them. But Solomon says, if you do this, it will produce strife. And strife is basically anger. And he says, if you do this, it will produce peace, which is the opposite. So I thought I could walk you through some of these and try to help you apply what he says to parenting. Though the truth is, this should be helpful for all of us, because basically what I'm giving you are ways to make other people angry, and especially your kids. The first big way to get somebody angry is to be a sinfully angry person yourself. So if you have children that are really struggling with anger, it's a good question to ask, am I really struggling with anger? Angry parents tend to have angry babies. And there are a lot of Proverbs that talk about that, but one is Proverbs 15:18. And Proverbs 15:18 says this, a hot-tempered man stirs up strife, but he who is slow to anger quiets contention. So who stirs up anger? A hot-tempered man. So you'll meet people sometimes who yell and scream at their wives and their children, and they can't figure out why their wives and children yell and scream at them. They don't have any self-control because you don't have any self-control. When a child is growing up in a family with an angry parent, he learns to become angry himself. He's literally being discipled in being ticked off. I often think this even as I drive, you know, what am I teaching my children about how to relate to other people when they cut me off? Sometimes I tend to be a little bit of not a yeller at all, but when I'm driving, sometimes I really like to instruct. I'm a self-righteous driver. I really like to instruct the other people. So if I'm going around a circle and they go cut in front of me, I'll really be very easy for me to say, that is not how you drive around a circle. And so it's funny to listen to my girls sometimes as we'll drive somewhere. They can be very self-righteous passengers as well, as they talk about all the other people and the ways that they're driving poorly. And I'm realizing, of course, that I'm discipling them in that. They learn through imitation. And obviously, children learn how to deal with conflict. One way is through you saying, do this, don't do that. But a more profound way they learn how to deal with conflict is by watching the way mom treats dad, dad treats mom, and the way you treat them. So angry, if you want to have an angry child, be angry. Proverbs 22, 24, and 25 puts it like this. It says, don't make a friendship with a man given to anger, nor with a wrathful man, lest you learn his ways and entangle yourself in a snare. So a friendship with a guy who gets angry is dangerous because he rubs off on you. Ephesians 4:26 shows us there's a supernatural element to this. Paul says, when you don't deal with your anger biblically, you give the devil an opportunity. And it's like what he's saying is, when you're sinfully angry and you don't deal with it, you're leaving the door open for the devil to come in and cause all kinds of destruction in your family. And the point of this is, as a parent, Paul's command not to provoke your children to anger means you need to set the pace in your family and show your children the right way to deal with anger. As selfish people, there are all kinds of things every day that we can get mad about, and you need to show your family what it looks like to be self-controlled when you're not getting what you want. So those moments when you're at the grocery store and you know, they say, even though they have that little card machine there, they say, no, sorry, we're not accepting cards. You got to walk from here and go all the way over to the ATM and get money and come back. And when you get back, they make you go to the back of the line again. And you have your two children with you. That right then is a moment to teach them about how to deal with anger, or how to deal with frustration, at least. All of those things. Don't just think that the only times you teach your children about how to deal with frustration is when they're not getting what they want. You teach them about how to deal with frustration when you're not getting what you want. And so there may even be times where you sit down with your kids and you're really just worked up about something and you're on a drive somewhere and they're talking about this or that and you have to say, honey, you know, right now, daddy is or mommy is really trying to process. I'm a little discouraged about something that's happened and I'm really trying to process this and I don't want to respond to you in a way that's unhelpful or sinful. But if you don't mind just praying for daddy right now as I try to respond in a biblical way. My emotions are all worked up and I'm trying to get them down to a normal level so I can speak in a ways that are helpful. And so will you just pray for daddy? It's not you. It's just I'm a sinner and I'm trying to deal with my own sin. And we'll talk about this in a few minutes. But what you want to do is you want to show them what self-control looks like. And so when children struggle with self-control, it's always an opportunity to ask, is it because I struggle with self-control? A second way to provoke your children to anger is to speak in harsh or pain-producing ways. If I want to get your attention, I could come to you and pat you on the shoulder. Or if I wanted to get your attention, I could come up to you and slap you in the face. Either way, I'm going to get your attention. But there are going to be some pretty different reactions, obviously. The same is true with the way you speak. Some people, the way they speak is like a slap in the face. And really, they shouldn't be surprised when others respond by getting angry. I mean, I have a responsibility. If you come up and slap me in the face, I have a responsibility not to get sinfully angry, but it's sure going to be a lot more tempting. And if the way that you speak is like a slap in the face, the other person has a responsibility not to get angry, but you are really making it difficult for them. You're really making it tempting. Solomon says it like this, Proverbs 15:1. A harsh word stirs up anger. So you have to think about that word harsh. What could it refer to? It could refer to the content of your words, or it could refer to your tone. You can slap people in the face with what you say, or you can slap them in the face with how you say it. If you need, and sometimes how you say it can be very difficult for you to even hear because you're so used to it. It's kind of like, I don't know if you've ever talked to somebody who has headphones on and they're listening to loud music and they're like, hey, how are you? And they're talking all loud at you and they don't even realize that they're talking so loud. Well, I think some people grew up in families where everybody spoke in such harsh ways that they don't always appreciate how harsh what they're saying sounds to others. And so some of us need help with this. I've even noticed moving to South Africa, and I'm sure you would notice this about Americans in a different way, perhaps, if you moved to America. It's hard to notice when it's your own culture, maybe, sometimes. But I've noticed that in South Africa, sometimes, there's a different way people have of talking to people of different social classes or races than them, that I'm wondering sometimes if the people even notice how much their voice changes from one person to another. I'll see this again at Pick and Pay, you know, somebody talking to me in the line and then somebody talking to the person behind the till. Or I remember one time, the worst was I was pulling out of Menlyn Mall and the guy backed into me and hit me. And so he got out of the car and I was just sitting there. He got out of the car and it was at one of these booms. And so there was a security guard who, you know, the guy who just, all he's doing is there sitting, putting the ticket in. I don't even know how he makes money doing that, but he sits, puts the ticket in. It's really a hard life when you need somebody to put your ticket in the thing. I always feel way too wealthy. That and when they pour your soda at the restaurant, I'm like, I don't know how to pour my own soda? Like, am I really that wealthy? Are you going to feed me next? But anyway, they put the ticket in that thing for you. So the guy got out and he was like, oh, how you doing? You know, so sorry to me. And then he goes over to the security guard. I can't believe you let this happen. And the security guard's like, I'm not even driving here. I'm just standing here putting your ticket in there. And then he's like, oh, and then he goes to the security guard. You, who do you think you are? I was like, wow, what a difference of change of voice just from like one moment to another. But The point is, sometimes we need help, especially if we're in it, hearing how we sound. And certainly with your children, you can help them with that. But also, you can ask your husband or wife humbly to help you with that, and just to have the free rein to let you know if you speak in ways that may really slap people in the face. And especially ask them to help that with you if you notice people's responses to you seem surprising. In terms of your conversations, you can't figure out why people are getting upset so often. If you need some examples of harsh words, Proverbs gives us that. Proverbs 11:12 talks about belittling speech. And I like that English word. It basically is speech where you say to somebody, in the way you talk to them, belittle. Belittle. That's where a parent talks in such a way to make his child feel like a fool. Do you have a brain? You idiot. Another kind of harsh word that Proverbs talks about are rash words. Proverbs 12:18. Rash words are words that are spoken in the heat of the moment without thinking. So those are words that you use like a knife in a fight just to jab at somebody. So what happens is anger wakes up our selfish desires and puts the security guards of our mouth to sleep. And so it's easy for attacking words just to rush out. And when that's something that's happening on a regular basis, it produces children who do the same thing. Now, I need to give you two warnings, and you should give the people you counsel warnings. First of all, they should listen to the way their children talk to one another and just ask, are we teaching them this? But also realize that when you have the television on all the time, the people your children are watching are training them in this stuff as well. Now, I don't think this is true of every culture, but I will say, when I go on visits for our church, I am shocked at how often the television is on and how little thought there is to turning the television off. Even when the pastor comes over, in the particular culture in which I work, it is hilarious. The television will be right there, and it's still on while we're trying to have a conversation. And that just tells me that probably that thing is on all the time. And you have to realize, if that television is on all the time with your children around, those people are discipling your children in how to talk to other people. And so don't be surprised when they start imitating what they see on TV as well. And of course, that's a challenge for some of our friends that live in flats with like four families. I think that's one of my dreams is to have a fair rent kind of program where you could have at least the possibility of living with your own family in a flat, because some of the struggles I see in parenting in my church come from the fact that there's like four different families living in the same flat. And they have all these different philosophies of parenting, and everybody feels like the responsibility to each other's children. And a second warning is that sometimes when you grow up in a certain place around certain people who have a certain way of speaking, you don't even know how harsh that way of talking is because you're used to it. And I mentioned that. If your children are really harsh in their language and seem angry, you need to stop as a parent and evaluate the way you speak as well. A third way we make our children angry is to refuse to overlook mistakes or sins. And we just said, imagine someone who felt it was their job to correct every mistake that you ever made. And what would be worse is if they kept bringing it up to everyone over and over. I think that would drive us crazy, and yet that's the way some parents are with children. Proverbs 10:12 says, hatred stirs up strife, but love covers over all offenses. So hatred looks for opportunities to create conflict. But when you love somebody, you're willing to overlook times when they hurt you. You don't have to bring up every sin or mistake. But when you don't love someone, you're constantly pointing out the errors that they're making. And you can probably see that in your own life. When you really care about somebody and they do something that's offensive to you, you can be like, okay, that hurt a little bit, but I love that guy. And yet, once there gets to be a little bit of bitterness in your hearts towards somebody, they could do the same thing And you're talking about that for like 3 weeks with your wife. And this small little thing that for somebody else would maybe be small, you would overlook it because you love them. Because there's bitterness towards that person. You hold that against them. You know, they are an evil person because of that. Well, we would all say we love our children, but we need to be careful we don't hate them in the way we act, where every time they fail, we have to point it out to them and shove it in their faces. And so if your children are angry, you might just ask, do I show them any grace? And you know, the tricky part of this is don't allow older siblings to do this with younger siblings. And what I mean is, of course, they should show them grace, but don't allow older siblings to constantly bring up the mistakes and sins of their younger siblings. We see this with 9 children. My wife will often say to the older children, please let her be 3 years old. Or remember, she's being 5, because she has to remind them to let the younger ones make mistakes. They're still young and learning. And so even another way children make their, you know, siblings can make their siblings angry is if you have someone who constantly has to feels the responsibility to tell mom and dad every time the other person does something wrong. That gets to be a little tricky sometimes with siblings, doesn't it? Because they have to learn how to deal with each other's sin without just bringing it to mom and dad. And so you need to teach them while they're young how to confront sin. Fourth, another way Proverbs says you can make your children angry is by being so sure of yourself all the time that you don't take other people's suggestions seriously. So you know that the always right dad even when he's wrong. Some guys have mastered the art of never admitting that they don't know something or that they've made a mistake, even when it's obvious to everyone else. These guys are pretty impressive. They can totally be wrong, but if you would look at them, the way they're looking would make you think they are absolutely convinced they're right. And if they are wrong and everybody in the family knows they're wrong, nobody can say they're wrong because you don't tell dad he's wrong. No, that's the recipe for an angry family. Proverbs 13:10 puts it like this: by insolence comes nothing but strife. And insolence means someone who won't take advice. There's hardly anything more frustrating than someone who's overconfident in his own abilities and in his own knowledge. And you know what? Your children can see that. And for a while, you might intimidate them. But they'll soon learn that you're just hot air. And after a while of you talking so arrogantly and refusing to humble yourself and take direction, they will become bitter at you, or at least be tempted to, for not being willing to listen to good counsel. So when your children become angry all the time, you might just look at yourself and ask, do I ever admit that I don't know or that I'm wrong? Or at least if you're counseling someone with angry children, just watch for a pattern. Is this a person who really has to have everybody think he always knows the answer? Is this a person who's willing to take advice, to take correction? Again, obviously, children are responsible for their sins, but this is at least an opportunity to do some self-evaluation. Fifth way to make your kids hate you is to be always focused on your own personal best, and to be so focused on your own personal best that you're willing to step over your children to get it. So there are some people, they're selfish, and when they don't get what they want, they blow up, and everybody knows it. But there are other people who are a little sneakier than that. And so they're still self-centered, but they've learned to like be a little cooler, a little smoother. And so they're manipulators. They're always scheming in their minds how to get what they want. There's a contrast in Proverbs 14:17. It says, a man of quick temper acts foolishly, and a man of evil devices is hated. Now get this. The man of evil devices is a schemer. So the quick-tempered man, he has no control over his emotions. He wants something, doesn't get it, he blows up. The man of evil devices is a little different. He keeps his emotions in check, but that doesn't mean he's better than the hot-tempered man. No, he's thinking, he's making plans about how he can get what he wants and even use other people to get it. And you know, there are parents like that. They're always scheming and planning how to get their own way, And you know, because they're older, they're smarter than their kids. They don't just freak out, you know, hopefully, and just flail on the ground when they don't get what they want. But they're just as self-focused. And so they're looking for ways to manipulate their children or use their children to get what they want. And Solomon says, you know what happens to a person like that? He's hated. Even his own children end up hating him because he's so self-centered. And so if your children are angry, it might just be a wake-up call for you to ask yourself, or the person you're counseling to ask themselves, are you so focused on yourself and what you want that you barely notice your kids and what's best for them? 6, you provoke your children to anger when you always have to win every argument, even arguments that don't matter. If you've ever taken a dog for a walk, you know there are some dogs who have to chase anything that moves. They see the smallest thing, even grass blowing in the wind, and they're gone. And when it comes to arguments, there are people like that. They have to chase any chance for an argument. They can't let it go. Anytime there's a chance to show someone else that they know a little better than them, they take it, they're gone. And sometimes people do that with their kids. You'll find these grown people who will get into an argument with the youngest kids about the smallest things because there's no one wise enough in the family to say, you know what, the color of the carpet was at that house we stayed at 3 years ago is really not a subject worth fighting about. This dad and this child are arguing about the fact that it was blue or red for like 15 minutes. And you're thinking, wow, man, somebody's got to be wise enough to say, who gives a rip? It was a carpet. And even if it wasn't, who cares? The writer of Proverbs talks about these kinds of people. It describes them as people who love quarrels. And it says you shouldn't be surprised that people who love to fight experience a whole lot of conflict in their life. Proverbs 23, every fool will be quarreling. And you've probably met people who you could get in an argument with them by just saying hello. You're like, hello, and then they're arguing with you. You're like, wow, where did that come from? I just tried to say, how are you doing? But those are the kind of people that create lots of conflicts. If you always have to argue about everything and you always have to win, don't be surprised you have angry children. 7, when you're a mocker, you provoke your children to anger. And by mocker, I mean somebody who gets a kick out of making fun of children. They say small people enjoy making fun of small people, right? We sometimes think it takes two to quarrel, but sometimes it only takes one. When you have a person who enjoys hurting other people with his words, you're going to have angry children. Proverbs 22:10 says this, you drive a scoffer out and strife will go out and quarreling and abuse will cease. So you get rid of the scoffer, all of a sudden it's peaceful. So there's a person who loves to mock and as a result, there's lots of quarreling in the family. Now, obviously there's a difference between teasing your children and mocking your children. Laughing with your children and laughing at them. Now, you want to be careful that you don't assume you're laughing with your children when actually you're the only one laughing. Sometimes people actually find pleasure in making others feel stupid. And it's weird, but even with their children, there are men and women who sometimes get a kind of pleasure in making their child feel inadequate. And if you know someone who enjoys that feeling, just plead with them, something's wrong there. And the good news is that there's a savior for that. Jesus came for sinners, even sinners who are so messed up, they make fun of small children. But the thing is, they have to recognize it as sin. And as another example of how you can't save yourself because there's something deep down wrong with you on the inside. In our home, with so many kids, there can be joking and teasing, but we often remind our kids in these times, as long as everyone is laughing, it's fun usually. But if someone's getting upset or sad, it's no longer joking, but being unkind. And that's obviously not fine. One thing we can do as parents is even teach our children how to joke with others, to have fun while paying attention to the other person's reaction and how it's making them feel, and to take that actually very seriously. Another thing, of course, is just to know your children. There are some children that it's easier to tease, and then there are other children who are really sensitive, and they obviously need to become stronger, but you just have to realize that the same word to that other child is going to be taken a different way. Even, I think, in terms of children being different than you, sometimes your child has a very different gifting or a very different personality, and so you want to be careful that you don't view that difference as an opportunity for mocking just because you don't understand it as well. I think of men with little girls, how sometimes little girls late at night can get so emotional. You know, you're just like, wow, where did these tears come from? This is like really something. But to be careful that you don't use the differences between men and women as an opportunity for mocking. Also, husbands and wives can really develop a way, if they're not careful, where the husband is mocking the wife or belittling the wife in front of the children, or the wife mocks the husband behind his back. And those are the kinds of things that there are ways of training our children and often result in angry children. Another way that Proverbs brings up, and this is an interesting one, greedy parents often produce angry children. Proverbs 28:25 says, "A greedy man stirs up strife, but the one who trusts in the Lord will be enriched." So where you find people that make money a god, you'll often find angry children. That's a kind of ironic. Sometimes people say they're so focused on getting more money for the purpose of making their children's life more pleasant. But if you make money a god and you serve it, what usually will end up is the opposite. Your children's life doesn't become more pleasant, but more full of strife. Ninth, and I'll just mention some of the rest of these, but one other way of making your children angry is by saying mean things about them when you should be supporting them. So here's a person, for example, your child gets a bad grade, and you know that your child got this bad grade and it wasn't a lack of effort. They actually did try. And yet, for some reason, when you went to school, it was easy for you. You know, you were a real student. And so your child gets this bad grade and is discouraged about it, and all you can do is say things like, "A D? Are you serious? I never had a D a day in my life. If I had gotten a D, my dad would have kicked me out of the house," or something like that. And when actually what they need from you at that point perhaps is support. How can we get better? How can we work on this? 10th way of making your children angry is by making being the one in charge and getting other people to respect you the most important thing in your life. So if you're so competitive, you're so ambitious, you have to have everybody respect you, and you come home from work and you're just complaining all the time about how they don't respect you, and you're just so focused on exalting yourself like that, you're often going to produce angry children. 11th way to make your children angry, hold back the resources they need to do well for purely selfish reasons. So it's funny how selfish you can be. I often think this in terms of finances, how say you cannot have very much money, but you need something as a dad and you're the one who's in charge of the finances. It's easy to spend money for yourself, but then your child comes and asks for something that they need as well, and it's a legitimate need, and you can be like, "Are you sure? You know, this is going to be suffering for us," you know, but sometimes we hold back what our children need, not because we don't have it, but actually because we'd rather spend it on ourselves.
Sorry, I just wondered if you could give us the proverb references to these while you're going through.
Yes, I'm frustrated because when I preached through these, I didn't write the Proverbs reference down for those three. I'm about to get to where I can.
All right.
So that's on the videotape. I made a mistake. But yeah, when I preached through it, I forgot to write the reference down and I didn't have time yesterday to work on it.
Thanks.
I was afraid you were going to ask that question. I was trying to get through the ones where I had the references again and start emphasizing that. But look in the Proverbs for the times where it talks about stirring up strife. That's all I did. And for some reason, I didn't write it down when I wrote those down. But by returning evil for good is the 12th one, the 12th way to stir up strife. I think an example of that might be if your child works hard at making you a special dinner and you, for some reason, the food doesn't turn out quite right and you say, wow, I don't know what you could say that's mean, but something like, nice try, or man, you're going to really have to work on your cooking skills, aren't you? Something, here's somebody's tried to do something that's good for you and yet you're looking for ways to mock them. 13th, now we can get to some of the proverb references that I wrote down. Proverbs 23:12, not teaching your children wisdom. And 13, Proverbs 23:12 and 13 says, apply your heart to instruction, your ear to words of knowledge. Do not withhold discipline from your child. If you strike him with a rod, he will not die. If you strike him with a rod, you will save his soul from Sheol. The idea being if you don't discipline your child and teach them wisdom, you're actually teaching them foolishness, and folly leads to strife. That goes with this one as well. Not disciplining your children is a way to make them angry. Folly is bound up in the heart of a child, Proverbs 22:15, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him. So, and you know that you know this, isn't it funny how, and this sometimes happens when you go to visit family that's not believers, and you all of a sudden feel like you're so strict, even though in your home you don't feel very strict, but when you go to visit somebody who's an unbeliever with your kids, you feel like, wow, am I the most strict dad there ever was? Because there's like no rules. And then you start noticing, like, your kids actually have a bedtime, like at 7 and you know, or whatever you do in your family. And you're with this family, and there's, like, no rules. And then you're just watching their kids, and you're like, wow, these kids, the lack of structure and the lack of discipline doesn't make them more joyful, by and large. It's like, you know, crying. I always remember being at somebody's house for Christmas, and I mean, the way they did Christmas was they had all these presents in front of the tree, and it was like a pile, and basically they said to their kids, go, you know, and then they just like dove in, and you could see like the legs on the top, you know, just in wrapping paper everywhere, and I mean, I've never seen that many presents, and me and my kids were like, whoa, so I hope you like the sweater I got you, and by the end, one of the kids, the only thing that they said to their dad was, you didn't get me the bike I wanted. And I was thinking, wow, you see that huge pile that you have there. But not disciplining your children tends to not produce more content children. It actually tends to produce more discontent children. We were talking earlier about some of the people who say, well, we don't want to have children because we just want me time. And I was thinking, it's kind of funny because I think one of the things that goes in with that is that people don't know how to have structure for their children. And so having children ends up being a lot more chaotic than it needs to be. So for example, with our younger children, they all go to bed around 7 o'clock. And often when people are at our house, they're kind of like, whoa, where'd the kids go? You know, because they kind of just go off and go to bed at 7. And we, Marta and I will have, now that the teenagers are there, it's a little less, but Marta and I will have from 7 to 9, 7 to 10, if you like to stay up later. I'm kind of an old man before my time. Right around 9 o'clock, I'm pretty ready. But 7 to, I guess having a lot of kids maybe made me old like that. But 7 to 9, 7 to 10, 2 hours of quiet. I mean, how much more time do you want with your wife? That's pretty good. That 2 hours, I mean, you want all the time you can get, but I mean, you can get a lot of talking in 2.5 hours, at least usually. So some of that comes from just trying to have an orderly home. And, you know, when kids love, in general, really love structure. They really do. I don't know if it's part of the way God designed us, but if you just have simple structures in place, It's amazing. It doesn't make their life less joyful. I mean, especially if you're not a jerk about it, but if you're just simple about it, these normal, orderly structures where things happen the way they usually happen, it's like a place for kids to thrive. A 15th way to make your children angry is not taking your children's heart's troubles seriously. I think Proverbs 25:20, whoever sings songs to a heavy heart is like one who takes off a garment on a cold day and like vinegar on soda. So what he's saying is you sing songs to somebody who's sad, it's like taking off their jacket when it's cold. It makes their life harder. And sometimes we do this with children. They're sad about things that seem silly to us. We're like, seriously, honey, it's not that big a deal that you have a pimple. I mean, there are people that are starving. But what can happen is if we don't realize that this is a big deal to them, and we just kind of minimize their suffering, their sorrows, we can easily make them angry. 16th, lying to your children and then making up silly excuses for your lies. Proverbs 26:18-19. Like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death is the man who deceives his neighbor and says, I'm only joking. And so even with our children, we can do that. For example, we try to be careful about the promises we make to our children. So if you have a consistent pattern of saying to your children, I promise that we'll do this. And then when you're not able to do it, you have some kind of excuse, work, or if you do that on a consistent pattern, if you do that consistently, Proverbs 26:18-19, if you do that consistently, that's an easy way to make an angry child. So remember, when you make a promise, when you say something to your children, they're a person. So if you say something that's not true to them, that's a lie. So be very careful about saying things that are not true to your children. 17th, talking without thinking about whether the timing is appropriate is an easy way to make people angry. This is actually, the list I'm giving you is not just for children. It could be for marriages, you know, all of these things. Proverbs 27:14, whoever blesses his neighbor with a loud voice rising early in the morning will be counted as cursing. So here's a guy who's doing something good, blessing, but at the wrong time, and it sounds a lot like cursing. So if you talk without thinking about the timing, so for example, you can think of a husband and wife with this. They're going to go to a special meal, and they're in the car on the way to the special meal with all these people, and the husband says something like, well, that's really not a very nice dress that you're wearing. Well, maybe there's a time for him to say that's not his favorite dress and a way to say it, but obviously on the road to the restaurant where she has no chance to change is probably not going to be the best time for saying something like that. And so even with our kids, sometimes I think we forget that they're little people, and so we say stuff about them in front of other people that we would never want somebody to say about us. And we even have to be I think careful with adoptive children as an example. Adopted children, a lot of parents will tell their story constantly to other people in front of them. So, oh yeah, their mother abandoned them. You know, they're like 8. Their mother abandoned them, and then the father's a drunk, and we're so thankful that they're with us. And you're thinking, this child's right there. You're telling, that's their story. If they wanna tell that to other people, then they can choose to tell that to other people. But for you to go around, you wouldn't like it if somebody went around saying, oh, your dad was this and your mom was this and look at how God worked it out in your life without at least you giving them permission to do that. 18th, letting your children do whatever they want to do all the time, regardless of whether it's good for them or not. And here's some others that I didn't get a chance to write the Proverbs down, so we'll look them up. You know, I gave you homework. You have to figure out where I found these from. Let me know so I can write it down. Not dealing with sin in a biblical way is a way to make somebody angry. And examples of this would be when you say you forgive somebody, but you keep bringing it up for years and years and years, that's a way to make people angry. And it's a lie. You remember what forgiveness is? It's a promise you make not to hold somebody's sin against them. And so when somebody asks you for forgiveness, they're bringing to you this debt that they owe you. They're putting it in your hands. They're saying, I can't pay you back this debt. And you're saying, I wipe it clean. I'm not going to hold it against you any longer. I choose to bear the pain of your debt. I'll suffer in your place, in a sense. That's what forgiveness is. And so when you say you forgive somebody and then you keep coming back and making them pay for the debt, that's an easy way to make them angry. And it's just unfair. So one way to make them pay is you keep putting their nose in it. Another way to make your children angry is not encouraging them when they're worried. Another way is making a habit of overreacting when your children mess up. Overreacting, a habit of overreacting when your children mess up. So to take something that is either a mistake or even a sin and taking a molehill and making a mountain out of it. My mom always used to say I had a skill of making mountains out of molehills. But sometimes we do that with our children. Another way, the final way I have here, is setting unrealistic expectations for your children and refusing to be patient with them as they try to do the right thing. So certainly you know at work, at least as an example, if somebody's expectations of you are out, you know, that's not even close to what is possible for you to do, and then they don't even give you the time to do it, how easily tempted you are to anger. And sometimes parents are like that with their children. I mean, be careful too. Sometimes you might be really good at something I'll give you two examples. Sometimes you might be really good at something and your children just aren't as good. And those are times where it's really can be easy to have anger both ways. So like for me, when I was growing up, I think, you know, you always have a rosy view of yourself. So we'd have to ask my mom, but I think school was pretty easy for me as far as I remember it. And so, as far as I remember it, at least, maybe I'm wrong, but that's the way I remember it. And so, one of our children, it's not, homework is not easy for her. And so she'll be doing maths, and it'll be like 2 + 2 = and she really likes to please, so she's looking at you to try to figure out what you want her to say. So she's like, 2 + 2 = 3, and then 5, 7, 2, 4, 4. You know, and to me, I can just barely handle it after like 5 minutes, you know, like, seriously, 2 + 2 = 4. I mean, you know this. Or, Muzi, when he first came to our house, or a little while after, we wanted him to get dressed by himself. And so that was difficult for him. He would get his sock, and he would take the sock, and then he would just flop it on his foot. And then he'd take it and just flop it on his foot. And he would do that for maybe half hour. You know, I'm like, Moosey, grab the sock, put your foot in it. And he could do it after like 45 minutes, but only after 45 minutes of taking it, flopping it on. And I mean, seriously, after like 3 minutes, I'd have to walk. I'd say, Marta, I cannot handle it anymore. Either I'm going to put the sock on or, you know, somebody else, I'm just got to leave the room because I cannot watch this. But it's easy when something's easy for you to believe that it can be difficult for somebody else. And so you can overreact in those instances. And then the other is, I think sometimes when you've known something for so long, you forgot how hard it is to learn it. We had somebody that we tried to teach to read. And this guy was a smart guy, but he was older. And I'm not a teach to read person, but I tried to teach him to read a couple weeks. So I worked at it. And he's a smart guy. But man, it made me realize being able to read is like a miracle. Because, I mean, trying to teach somebody to read when they've never done it, it's like, no, you just look at it. It's there, you know, like now is now. I don't know how to say that's just what it is. And you forget how hard it must have been when you had to learn to read. And the same is true with parenting children. I think sometimes we just forget how difficult certain things can be. And so we can put these expectations for them that are really unrealistic. I don't know how you respond to some of those examples, but for me, I'm thankful Scripture is pointed. I mean, if you look through Proverbs, I didn't give you all the Proverbs, but you could look through it. It's amazing how much Scripture has to say about how we provoke other people to anger. Also, when you hear some of those things, it's easy to get convicted because you realize, man, I could provoke people to anger very easily. And that's uncomfortable for some of us to be convicted because we like to think good thoughts about ourselves. And so we try to get those bad thoughts out of the picture as quickly as possible. But it's good for us to feel conviction because there's a Savior for sinful people. And we are that. I mean, what could be more messed up than taking this gift that God's given us, children, and tempting them to get angry? It's just weird. But we do. And instead of trying to get out of the conviction, let that conviction of sin take you to the cross. This is the kind of stuff your Father sent Jesus to die for. And you, as you're at the cross, thinking about how much your Father loves you, I'm praying God will use that to make you a person who wants to imitate the Father in your relationship with your children. That you'll be the kind of parent like God who delights so much in the good of your children that you're willing to make great sacrifices that they might know his love and they might know your love. And when you know his love for you, you obviously want to turn from tearing your children down to fulfilling your role in their life, which is to build them up. And we'll talk about that just in a moment now. But I wonder if there's any questions or thoughts as we think about our first responsibility here in Ephesians 6:4, not provoking our children to anger. Any questions or thoughts? Do you think, can you think of any other ways that people might provoke their children to anger? Any ways that you've done any of these things? Okay, up here, sorry.
I think we sometimes don't let our children grow up. Yeah. And we always remind them, oh, when you were little, you did this, and yeah. You were so stupid.
Yeah, that's true. You're like 35, and you're still being reminded in front of everybody of how you were when you were 5. Or more like a teenager, too, being treated like a 4-year-old. It's a difficult balance, I think, in these teen years to figure it out. With McKenna, she got to take the trip back to visit her grandparents by herself, so she flew on the plane by herself. She's 14, so I was sitting there thinking as she was leaving, but she had you hire a chaperone or something. But I was sitting there thinking, now, this is a good question, Josh. Is this too, are you crazy for letting her do this on her own, or are you wise for allowing her to become a young lady and feel some sense of independence and responsibility? Sometimes it's hard to know the difference. Am I pushing too fast, or am I holding too tight? But pray. Certainly they're going to stand before God, so we do need to, the goal is not for them to stay 5 years old for the rest of their life, though they are cute at that age, but it's maybe not so cute when it's a 32-year-old acting like a 5-year-old in your house. Though I did realize that when McKenna and the girls get married, I am going to weep like a little baby. Because, man, when she went behind that that counter, and I couldn't have access to her anymore, wow, I was getting so emotional. And I don't usually think of myself as an emotional guy. Then the other thing I realized is, wow, all of our lives are headed towards tragedy unless there's resurrection from the dead. Because there's a day coming when there is going to be that separation. And I'm going to go into the ground and she's going to come to my funeral. And there's not going to be that. So I'm so thankful for the resurrection because, wow.
I think unfulfilled promises. If you promise your kids things, and I mean, obviously things come up.
Yeah.
But if you're constantly saying, we're going to go do this, and then you don't do it.
A pattern of that, yeah. You just end up being and it's easy. You have to be disciplined not to have unfulfilled promises. because you really have sometimes good intentions, but life happens. I've noticed that in myself as well. Be careful not to say too much too early. Sometimes that's, I tend to be, I don't like to even have, I like to open Christmas presents like a week before. I'm the kind of guy that doesn't like a surprise. And so, but the bad part with that is, one of the bad parts is that you can say your hopes to your children for them before you've done the work of figuring out, can it actually happen? And so you can easily get them so excited about something, and you really mean well, but you haven't carefully considered if it's even feasible. Any other ideas?
The other one that I'm thinking about, to be overprotective, and I'm linking it to not trusting God, that they can be by themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a real, an interesting one to think through in terms of, obviously, part of our responsibility as a parent. God uses us as a means to protect them and to care for them and provide for them. But at the same time, we can become so obsessive about it because we almost begin thinking or acting like we are God and able to completely protect them. It's interesting how different cultures too are about that. Sometimes I'll walk through Sunnyside, drive through Sunnyside late at night and coming home from a Bible study or something, and be really amazed at the age of kids that you see walking on the side of the street by themselves. I mean, down to like, I'd like to say 6 or 5 maybe, a brother and sister. And you're like, wow. But then on the other hand, in the culture I come from, they have this phenomena that in England they call laddism. You know how English people call boys lads? Well, they call it laddism, and that means like 32-year-old men that are still acting like 5-year-old boys in their families because their parents haven't really pushed them to become men.
Another thing that also has come to mind is like when people try to cocoon their kids from the world. I mean, I have a friend that just refused to send her kids to school, to public school, because she saw that's evil. And so she homed her kids right through. And even allowing her kids to play with other, like non-believers, it was not acceptable. And if we cocoon our children like that, what are we teaching our children? That there's no evil? Mm. I mean, they must be aware that evil is around us, and we have to make them see how to deal with it and not, close their eyes to it as if it doesn't exist.
Mm. Yeah, a little heaven on earth, but it's not. But yeah, exactly. Teaching them to be Pharisees sometimes as well. And not recognize that there's evil inside too. You know, if you try to cocoon your house from all evil, you can't be in it. You know, because you're more of a sinner than you think, or I'm more of a sinner than I think. And also, man, what a great time to teach your kids. You have to think through how to do it, but while they're in your home, to teach them how to respond to the sin in the world, rather than when they're out of your home.
Josh, I'm sitting here very brokenhearted. You know, I'm a teacher. I don't want to go into that. At what stage do you think people should get involved with this type of counseling? We all can sit here now. We're all listening. We all become amateur providences now. We all know these things. We know about marriage like we've never known before. But none of us know these things before we get involved.
Mm.
So what do we do? What does the church do to educate the people? You look at all the broken homes, broken families. And I talk from my own experience, and I'm broken as I sit listening to you.
Well, I think one thing the church needs to do, besides classes like this and all that and providing counseling, that we need to pray for and pursue in our churches is we need time with one another. Because some of this stuff it's easy to say here, but we need to be in homes and watching godly people and how they relate to their children and learning from them, because many of us didn't grow up being discipled. We've got patterns of junk for like 30, 20 years. And, you know, you don't overcome a pattern of bad example with just somebody saying to you, stop being angry or treat your kids nice. You know, you need somebody to watch. You need another pattern. You need another example. And that's very hard for us to get in our day and age, because sometimes we only see people, Christians, at church when they have their nice little suits and Bibles. So the only time we really have an example is of how to, the only example we have from a Christian is of how to sit in church. You know, everything else we're kind of on our own trying to figure it out. And that's not the way God designed us to figure everything out in terms of parenting and marriage. We need to be in each other's homes and seeing how life is being lived. That's why we love it when people are able to come and stay in our home for a significant period of time. I even think sometimes with deep parenting problems, I'm sometimes just wonder, you need more than just an hour of counseling. That's helpful, and some people are really good at drawing the information out quickly. But sometimes, even with parenting or marriage, you almost need to be there to see like how it's happening and to help people see another way of responding. But we need discipleship going on in our churches for sure, to make that a priority and not to just think that an hour a week on Sunday is going to be enough to overcome all these habits and patterns that we've developed over the years. But also you can see we can get discouraged, and we can just thank the Lord that he's such a patient God, and he's a God who's able to, he takes broken the people and makes beautiful things all the time. He's an expert at that. And even, you know, we've met godly Christians who have grown up in very pagan homes. And we've met pagan people who grew up in pretty Christian homes, you know. So we don't want to forget the power of the Holy Spirit and the power of the Word. And so we ask for forgiveness and we depend on God. So that's one of the things I would say in terms of that. Discipleship and thanking God that he can take our brokenness and use it to accomplish something beautiful. And then trying to change, and I think as parents especially, you can solve a lot of these problems, even if you have some of these patterns, by just being a person that asks for forgiveness, and then also being a person that allows your children to confront you, and then also by just admitting your own brokenness to your children. So, your children don't need, they have a perfect Savior, that's Jesus, and you're not perfect, so you don't have to pretend in front of them that you are. So allow them to say, I mean, what a great sanctification. It's hard to see yourself. I always say that when I'm running a race, I am always shocked at how slow people are who pass me. I always think, there is no way that somebody that slow can be passing me right now. Because in my mind, I am running like a king, you know. I'm like running, like, wind in my hair, you know, just going. And this little old guy, like, he's like passing me. I'm like, that's like physically impossible. And the point is that we have this view of ourselves that we think we're awesome at everything. And it's a beautiful thing to have a family where somebody can say, you know, Dad, you're not as good at that as you think you are. Or the way you're speaking right now, the way you're looking right now, it's tough. And so to be open for that and just to be thankful that God can use that to actually change us. Changing a person's hard work. It doesn't, we like to get stuck. So it's neat to have a family that is open enough to push you and be iron sharpening iron in your life. And I think if you're able to do that with your children, kids are pretty amazing in terms of how patient they can be as well, and how forgiving they can be, at least when they're young. Sometimes their hearts harden as they get a little bit older and tougher to forgive. But I think if there's a pattern of openness, at least when they're young, that will last. All right. Well, do we want to just stretch for 5 minutes if you need to use the restroom? Well, oh, do you know the story? Okay, sounds good. And then we'll look at our second responsibility and...